Welcome, listeners, and thank you very much for downloading this episode. Today is Sunday, November 13th, 2022, and due to some work and family commitments, Steve was unable to record this week, and we decided to air a rerun of a popular episode from about 10 weeks ago. We hope you enjoy it, and we look forward to seeing you again next week for our scheduled discussion about St. Andrew's Day. And now, without further ado, I give you Past Adam and Past Steve.
And Mercury and leading Mark.
Welcome to Views from the World Tree. On this week's show, we overthrow the bonds of capitalism, embrace anti-consumerism, and use our technology to bring balance to nature. That's right, we're talking about solar punk. And now, on with the show.
Ender and him alone.
Yes, I see. Good news, everyone.
All right. So for our news segment this week, I have been reading the Kaiju Preservation Society. I started reading this. Actually, it's been several months ago. So I kind of gave a preface about what it's about. I haven't really made a lot of progress. I just barely picked it back up today. But it's fun. It's John Scalzi, so it's that, you know, funny, witty sci-fi, if you're into that.
He is still probably one of my favorite authors in the sci-fi genre, because he does not take anything too seriously.
Yeah. Not even himself.
Right. I know last time you mentioned him in this book, I mentioned that I went to a Comic-Con where I got to sit in on one of his author talks, and he is just as funny in real life as he comes across in his novels. It's kind of fun.
Nice. And then as far as what I've been watching, my wife and I started watching the She-Hulk series on Disney Plus, which is, it is what it is. I feel like it's kind of letting down the actress. Like, I think the CGI is kind of not great. I think the scenes where she is herself, she does really well. But unfortunately, where she's all hulked up, it's kind of detracts from it, honestly, from her acting skills. But hopefully it'll get better as time goes on.
I hope so, too. But you have convinced me that my decision to cut Disney as one of my streaming services might have been right, because nothing really seems to be coming out worth watching right now.
Yeah, I haven't been impressed with the last few series that they've done, honestly. So, and then besides watching that, I have been getting hard into the Wrath Classic pre-patch for WoW Classic. So the pre-patch for Wrath of the Lich King dropped yesterday. Today's Wednesday, so yesterday. So I was able to get in, create my Death Knight. Also, it's been really fun doing the leveling. They still have the 50% XP boost. And then with the changes that came in Wrath of the Lich King, there was a big cut across the board to the amount of XP required for each level. So it's actually been really fast trying to level this guy. Also, I forgot how absolutely ridiculously powerful DKs were back in the day. So it's been kind of fun watching everything just melt.
Yep.
And then a little bit different than when I played through it when it first came out, I actually have been playing it a little bit on the Steam Deck. So I was able to get it running on that. So if you're watching the stream, you can see it here. So
that is kind of cool. How does the button combination work with all the hotbars and all that? Are you just limited?
So there's an add-on that is designed for playing it with a controller. So you can see the buttons at the bottom. They actually map to like the D-pad and then the A, B, X, Y. And then if you hold down either of the triggers, it's like your shift and your alt. So you get additional abilities there.
Okay.
But yeah, it actually plays really well. Like as far as the graphics, it's really crisp, really fun. Plays really great. It's a little bit finicky just because the Steam Deck runs Linux and there's not really a, you know, a Linux version of World of Warcraft, but you can install it through the Steam Deck's built-in emulation. It's called Proton, is like the compatibility thing. And now there's like YouTube guides on how to do it. If anybody's listening and they're interested in it, I don't want to go into details. Just look it up on YouTube. There's lots of good people that will walk you through it. But yeah, it's actually really fun. So
that is cool.
Yeah. And then as far as my news, excuse me, I did see a headline that actually kind of relates to our topic today that, and I'm sure a lot of people have heard of this by now, California passed a, I don't know if it was a law or a resolution, that they are going to ban the sales of new internal combustion vehicles by the year 2035. I assume that you've seen this. I was curious what your thoughts were. Do you think this is too soon? Do you think it's not soon enough? What do you think?
I saw that pop up the other day and I had two thoughts. My gut reaction was, oh my gosh, it's too soon. The technology, we have a lithium shortage right now. Like computer chips are super expensive. Like how are they going to do this? But then the other part of me was going, you know what? Like it's going to take places like California that passes this, that forces automobile makers to explore new technologies faster. So like it's a two-edged sword, right? Is it too early? Probably. But does it need to happen? Probably. So how's that for a very political center of the line? Like I'm not going to say one way or the other.
I don't think anybody could be upset by your answer there. So I kind of feel the same way. It seems really fast. But then at the same time, I mean, they're only banning the sale of newly manufactured internal combustion cars. It is 12 years down the road. And just looking back at how technology has come along in the last 12 years, I'm sure it's going to change quite a bit. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. I think, I don't know. I'm always a big proponent of let each individual state do whatever the hell they want. So if the Democratic majority of citizens in California really wants this, which I'm sure they do, then yeah, more power to them. I think the state that I live in will probably be one of the last to pass something like this if they ever do. But I do think that the automakers are going to have to like increase their rate of technological development to comply with this. And I think that's a win for everybody because it's not just going to be, you know, a plug-in electric vehicle technology. It's going to be technology that impacts multiple different sectors of the automotive industry, and everybody's going to benefit from that. Even, you know, internal combustion cars that are made over the next 20, 30 years are going to benefit from that.
Yeah. I honestly have two thoughts on why this might be rushed. My first one is California's GDP is extremely huge. They have a lot of money, but they have a lot of money because they have a lot of agriculture. If they're banning combustion engines, how is that going to impact the grape growers? How is that going to impact the almond growers? How is that going to impact the agriculture in California if they can't buy tractors? And then my second thought, just today, there was an article that popped up on my news feed that basically said, the governor of California is asking Californians to turn off their AC units during this heat wave because the power grid can't keep up. If everybody's plugging in their cars, what's going to happen to the power grid?
Yeah, I actually posed that question on a subreddit where I was talking about this with some people, and nobody really had a good answer. Everybody kind of pointed towards rate limiting during peak hours, you know, and having people charge overnight. But I don't know that that's going to fix it. Like, it'll help, but you're still going to have people that need to, you know, the equivalent of stopping at a gas station for a fill up during the day. I don't know.
Charging overnight is not going to work because they're trying to go renewable sources. And when does the sun shine?
I mean, yeah, that's a whole other thing we've talked about a lot.
We're hitting all the points that we talked about when we did our renewable energy episode last year. There's a lot of issues with converting to an electric vehicle without having all the contingencies.
Yeah, that energy storage issue.
Yeah.
So, it'll be interesting to see how it goes. I'm not against it by any means. Like I said, I do feel it's a little bit quick. And as much as I love it, sometimes I do get a little bit frustrated with the state of Idaho and how just ultra conservative they can be on every single topic. But in this case, I'm kind of glad because, I don't know, this is something I definitely would want to wait and see how it pans out before I am ready to adopt it.
So, the state that I live in, and I'm not afraid. I live in Colorado. It's a purple state, which for those of you not in America, that basically means that it's pretty centrist, both left-leaning and right-leaning. Our governor actually made a similar promise as far as new combustion engines, but he hasn't set a hard date yet because he wanted to make sure that there was the infrastructure to charge all these new vehicles. So he wanted to make sure that our two major freeway systems have enough rapid charge ports that if people were to switch, that they could find power for their vehicles. And so I kind of like that approach of, hey, let's make sure our infrastructure can handle it before we just tell people that we're banning them.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. Just in general, not just for stuff like this. I mean, here in Idaho, we've had crazy growth the last couple of years with everybody moving in from out of state, and we do not have the infrastructure to support just people in general, let alone electric cars. Mm-hmm. So infrastructure needs to be in place. Otherwise, people feel the pain of it, and you end up having to increase people's property taxes, and then people like me get frustrated. And
yeah.
So anyway, big tangent, not going to go there.
We could probably go on a whole episode about libertarianism and anti-taxation and all that stuff.
Oh, yes.
But that's not what this podcast is about.
Not this week. I better pass it to you before we go too much further.
So this week, as far as my reading, I'm in between books, so I've been looking at a bunch of different ones, and I've narrowed it down to my top three. Maybe you can help me decide, or our listeners can help me decide. The first one is called Night Watch. Have you ever heard of Night Watch? It's by an author called Sergei Lukyanenko. Sorry, Russian names are hard.
I have not heard of that one.
So I read this book before, and it is one of my all-time favorites. It's an urban fantasy horror, urban horror fantasy book. It's basically good and evil trying to balance each other out. There's a treaty amongst the good spirits and the bad spirits, or the good supernaturals, bad supernaturals, and they kind of watch each other to make sure that neither side gets too powerful. So Night Watch are the good supernaturals watching the bad supernaturals to make sure that they don't gather too much power. And it kind of reads like a Lord of the Rings in an urban fantasy taking place in post-Soviet Moscow.
Interesting.
It's It's really good.
I see that it's a series on Prime Video. Is that the same thing?
Oh, I didn't know. Let me look that up.
You said the book was by this Noknoi Dozor?
No, it's by Sergei Lukyanenko.
I'll have to look it up and add it to my list. It sounds similar to others that I've read. Oh, yeah, here we go. Night Watch, book one. Yeah, definitely we'll put this one on the wish list.
I'm guessing that this Night Watch TV show is not, because this looks like it's about first responders responding to emergencies overnight. So not the same one.
So as far as the book, have you read all six of them? I'm seeing that there's six.
There are six of them now.
Yes.
When I read them, it was the trilogy. I thought he was only doing a trilogy of Night Watch, Day Watch, and Twilight Watch.
Okay. Yeah, since then it looks like he's done The Last Watch, New Watch, and Sixth Watch. So
nice. I'll have to see if there's English translations of those. It's incredible. I actually picked up the book because the Russian film studio actually made a movie based off of it when I was working at a video store. So that tells you how long ago these came out. And I watched it and I'm like, oh, this is actually pretty good. And so I watched that one and then I watched Day Watch, and then the film studio decided that the movies weren't making enough money, so they never did anything else. But I had to know what happened, so I ended up finding Twilight Watch at the library. So it's a good series. I enjoy it. Nice. Urban horror fantasy is always interesting.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. So that's one that I've been looking at. Probably the one that I'm going to decide on after I talked about it, because it is fun. The other two were Leviathan Wakes. We talked about that recently.
Mm-hmm.
And then Undaunted Courage, which is the biography of the Lewis and Clark expedition. So those are kind of the three that I'm playing with right now.
Cool. Yeah, the Leviathan Wakes and Night Watch definitely sound interesting. I'm going to put them both on my list. In fact, Leviathan Wakes is on sale right now for Kindle, so I might just buy that.
Oh, there you go. I tried to read it, and it is a hefty book. I think it's like 700 or 800 pages.
Wow.
It's stupidly long, but it's your classic space opera, so, I mean, it's good.
Yeah. Yeah, one of my all-time favorite authors and series, Brandon Sanderson, who wrote The Stormlight Archive, is notorious for very, very long books, and that's one of my favorite series. So maybe I'll like this one too.
Nice.
Anyway.
Yeah. And then as far as watching, my wife and I, in an effort to save some money, have canceled all of our streaming services except for Netflix and Peacock. So we don't have cable. We don't have YouTube TV, Hulu, Disney, any of those. So before our Sling subscription expires, we are trying to go through National Geographic's doing National Parks Week, and they've got a bunch of different actors, musicians talking about their favorite national parks and kind of giving a David Attenborough style narration of what goes on in the parks. And so we've been watching that this week, which has been kind of fun.
Nice. I think I watched that one, or started to.
We watched the Yellowstone one with Garth Brooks and then started Big Sur.
Okay.
They've been good. They've been entertaining. I mean, nobody can beat David Attenborough.
Oh yeah, of course not.
But
Morgan Freeman comes close, but for wildlife stuff and nature, there's nobody better than Mr. Attenborough, Sir Attenborough.
That's true. He has been knighted. Yeah, so we've been watching that. And then it's actually funny that you found the car one, because I actually found a news article that also followed our topic today. So today I went on to Science Daily and I found an article about China, of all places, leading the way to carbon reduction in their urban environments. And at first I went, oh, it's China. And then I went, wait, it's Science Daily. They actually cite actual research. And so I clicked on it to try and figure that out. And so the study is from the University of Birmingham in the UK. And they found that 38 cities in China have managed to reduce their CO2 emissions over the last 5 years. And what they found is basically what the current idea is: we need a cookie cutter approach where the entire world follows the same limits for everywhere, no matter where you're at. And that's how we're going to get over an energy crisis. And China went, well, each city is different. We've got industrial cities, we've got urban centers, we've got commercial centers. Why are we trying the same approach that we would for an urban, like a commercial center, for a industrial sector? So they tailored an approach for each city to be slightly different. And they have found that by tailoring it to the area, that they have actually seen great success. So they've seen, even Beijing, one of the dirtiest cities in the world, has seen success. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was fascinating. The study did say, basically, towards the end, it did say that a lot of it could be the inflation rate right now. People just aren't buying goods. Lack of resources. There's not a lot of goods to produce. That there could be other variables that are kind of influencing whether, influencing industry to make sure that the cities are reducing their carbon. But there is also a systematic approach that China is employing, which is showing that some success that could be used elsewhere. One of the authors is from the Netherlands, and he was planning on taking it to some of the cities in the Netherlands and attempting to replicate the results in mainland Europe. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see the numbers like per capita, because I know that China is definitely, up there in total emissions, like more than anybody else, but they also have a lot of people.
Right.
So it'd be interesting to see how that maps per capita, but
That would be interesting. Just to see. I do know that from the study, they found that in China, cities account for 80% of the Chinese gross domestic product.
Mm-hmm.
60 to 80% of the energy usage, and around 75% of all carbon dioxide emissions come from city centers in China. And so their targeting of the cities is used basically saying, yeah, there's carbon emissions out in the farms or out in the rural communities, but really it's the cities that are using the most amount, so we should target them.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So, finally some news about something good that China's doing.
Yeah, it's been a while. Been a minute, like the kids say today.
Who would have thought? So, anyway, your thoughts, could, do you think it's legit? Do you think, or is it just a one-off, like economics are playing more of a role?
I mean, I'm kind of like you. Anytime I hear any type of statistics that come out of China, I always take it with a grain of salt. But based on the source that you have, Science Daily, I'm inclined to believe the numbers. And I mean, yeah, I'm very happy to hear that China is trying to address the the spewing of greenhouse gases into the world that they're currently responsible for. I hope they continue to do so. So,
with that being said, we're on to our main topic of the day. We are talking about solarpunk. Briefly, solarpunk is a subgenre of the science fiction genre of pop culture that is influenced more by utopian movement towards balance with nature. And we're going to talk a little bit about what it is, where it comes from, and could it become a reality? So, here we go.
Okay. So, what is solarpunk then? This was actually new to me when you suggested this for the topic. I had never heard of this. I've obviously heard of cyberpunk and steampunk, but I had never heard of this. And from what I read, apparently there is a concept called future punk, which is like an overarching umbrella. And then within that, you have all of these different thoughts at what the future could look like. You have cyberpunk, you have steampunk, and solarpunk is the one that you had suggested for this topic. Solarpunk is a sci-fi subgenre that looks at what the world would look like if humanity was able to solve the issues of climate change, inequality, and other contemporary issues, specifically with a focus on ecological sustainability and living in harmony with nature. It's commonly lumped together with utopian, dystopian literature. It can either be portrayed as a good thing or a bad thing, depending on how the content is written. And as an art style, solarpunk emerged in the teens, in the 2010s, as kind of an answer to the bleak, dark, dystopian art styles of the early aughts, early 2000s. The solarpunk art style is influenced by Art Nouveau styling, which emphasizes a very clean and comfortable look to the art, very bright colors. It also often utilizes high-tech options with low-tech sustainability. So similar to steampunk, you'll see very simple things like gardening and permaculture along like smart homes, flying cars, other very technologically advanced ideals. And then as far as an actual philosophy, solarpunk utilizes green ideals, environmentalism, ecology, social ecology, alongside kind of those future punk ideals like anarchism, anti-consumerism, anti-capitalism, decentralization, and civil rights.
Well said. The genre is really spoke to me. It's one of my all-time favorite genres. Just because of, because of my background, the environmentalist in me, I really, really enjoy this idea of living in harmony with nature and all of that. So it's it really speaks to me. The reason why I suggested this is I discovered this probably about 2 or 3 months ago, while I was cruising through Reddit subreddits and all of that, and I just really like the art style and all of that, so I kind of wanted to go into the culture of solarpunk, specifically the art and literature that we can find in it. So as far as the art, as Adam had said, it was developed in the 2010s and the 2020s, and people are saying that it was a response to the increasing temperatures and extreme climate events, such as today. Like, we've got flooding in Pakistan, flooding in Mississippi. We've got heat waves, we've got fires, all of that stuff. And so this was kind of an artistic movement to kind of put hope into society. So solar punk became an optimistic alternative to the post-apocalyptic dystopian literature and artwork. It uses bright colors, wavy lines, elements of nature in common in this, or elements of nature which are common in this art style. If you've played the video game City Skylines, they had a green expansion which utilized plants growing on buildings and kind of living locally sustainable. If you're a film critic or somebody who enjoys films, Wakanda, the city of Wakanda from the Black Panther, falls into the solar punk art style. Aroa, which is from Tom Clancy's Ghost Recon Breakpoint game, also kind of falls into this. And then there's a film studio based out of Japan called Studio Ghibli. They made two very solar punk films called Castle in the Sky and Nausicaa of the Wind of the Valley Wind, which are very solar punk. If you don't know what Ghibli is, it's a studio that does feature and short films. Some of their most famous are Totoro, Ponyo, and Howl's Moving Castle. So that kind of style of art is used in the solar punk art array. And the art is set to kind of portray feelings of cleanliness, abundance, and equity. And as I said, this art style just really, really speaks to me on in almost a like a almost to my soul, just because I think it would be awesome to live in a world where there's just trees and green everywhere and people getting along, and maybe to the Japanese film studio, like being able to walk and talk to my best friend Fish, type of thing. But you know, after the art, we're going to go on to books. So a lot of the books have been kind of added to this genre well after they were written. Frank Herbert's Dune is one that comes to mind with this idea of kind of fixing a desolate planet and turning it into a more sustainable future. So the themes of books tend to be oneness with nature, tend to have utopian ideals, the utilization of ecology and principles of ecology to create a balance with nature. And again, these feelings of cleanliness and abundance that we find in the art style. So I looked up a website called the 16 Best Solar Punk Books from bestscifibooks.com. There will be a link in the show notes. And I thought that these kind of showed the diversity of it. So the first book on the list that I chose was Glass and Gardens, Solar Punk Summers. This is an anthology of short stories, which all have a kind of a solar punk theme. And then another book is called A Door into the Ocean by Joan Slonczewski, and Eastern European names. I apologize. Not my strong suit. This book is about kind of a future moon world, and it involves a society of biologically advanced women who must defend themselves and their planet or their moon against invaders that would turn their home into like this capitalistic money-making dystopia. Another book kind of along the similar lines is Island by Aldous Huxley. Aldous Huxley's one of my favorite authors. He does a lot in the dystopian genre before the dystopian genre was really big. But the premise of this book is it's a pristine island that's been undisturbed for 120 years. And then it's discovered by a society that wants to utilize the resources that have been not disturbed and utilize them for a profit. And so it's kind of this, the island natives who have lived in harmony with nature are all of a sudden at odds against the big corporations that are trying to take it in. So again, the themes of living in harmony and exploitation of resources, consumerism, that type of thing. Ecotopia by Ernest Kallenbach is another book. Basic premise of this one, and I haven't read this one or heard anything about it, but it sounded fascinating. The West Coast basically leaves the United States. It secedes from the United States and creates their own nation. So California, Oregon, Washington, they pull away from the U.S. and form their own nation. They close their borders. Nobody knows what's going on in there. There's rumors of hedonism, sacrifices, nature worship, and like all these trigger words for the United States public have kind of demonized this this breakaway country. And then the book follows the first U.S. reporter that's allowed into this new nation, where he reports back on what's really going on in the country. And it's kind of the way the description read is he has to face the terms of what it means to be in a country that's governed a certain way compared to another way, and like the good and the bad type of thing. So that was interesting. And then the number one book on the site was The Dispossessed by Ursula K. Le Guin. And this one is basically Earth or another planet has broken out into all-out war, exploitation, all of that stuff. And so a group of survivors have gone to a very inhospitable planet. And in order to create a society that works, they need to figure out how to get along with each other. And so that's kind of the basis of that one. And I do apologize if I didn't do a great job describing that. But as I stated, it was voted the best book according to the site, so I felt like I had to put it on.
It does sound interesting.
Yeah.
So moving then into some of the films that have touched on this, the genre has not been super well defined in the film industry yet, but there are some films that fit it pretty well. So just a short list that maybe of movies that are not dedicated to this theme, but that have elements of it. So the movie Black Panther, the Marvel film, in that film, the city of Wakanda is seen by many in the genre fandom as the way that a solar punk country should be, where they have high technology, but they still focus on being one with nature and the world. Also, there's a film called The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. In this film, there's a young boy who's banned from school for being too poor. He utilizes the library to teach himself science and ends up bringing electricity to his village by building a windmill. Also, a film called Treasure Planet. This was an animated Disney film, I believe. As far as the story itself, it doesn't really align. It's more of like a treasure hunting. But both the sci-fi setting and the artwork definitely embody the styling of solar punk.
That was such a good film.
It really was. It was fantastic.
I really enjoyed that one. Yeah.
And while we're on the subject of animated movies, also the film WALL-E, also a Disney movie. This is a dystopian film about what the world might look like if humans keep up with the hyper-consumerism trend that is seen in most cyberpunk media. In the film, there are robots that help humans see the error of their ways as they try to reclaim the planet from pollution. Also, another film called Castle in the Sky. In this one, there are two kids, and in order to save the world, they must protect a magic crystal from being stolen from the military while they're searching for a floating castle. I don't think I've seen this one.
It's by the Howl's Moving Castle studio, okay. Ghibli, that I mentioned before. Okay. I haven't seen this one, but they do a lot of kind of topics of man versus nature and like that kind of conflict.
Right. And then one other one that I'm going to throw out. Did you ever watch Interstellar? I know we talked about it a few weeks ago and you hadn't seen it.
I still have not seen it.
Okay. I would say that that definitely fits. So the basic premise of the movie is that it's in the far future. They are fairly technical. Well, not the far future. It's in the near future. Sorry. They are technologically advanced. However, there's such a global food crisis and agriculture crisis that becoming a farmer is seen as much more desirable. And so the main character, Matthew McConaughey, was employed as an engineer, but he has to leave that profession and become a farmer because they don't need engineers, they need farmers. And there's a kind of like a blight type issue with the corn that's causing potential dust bowl conditions, and that's the whole reason why he falls back on that engineering background to try and build a spaceship to go and like search for a more suitable world for humanity to populate. So
yeah, that totally sounds like a solar punk kind of genre.
So yeah, really good movie, but I keep saying that. I'll get you to watch it one time, one day.
Oh no, I keep hearing about it. Time, it's all about time at this point, right?
Right. Yeah.
No, I'll watch it. I'm not afraid to watch movies. I watched a horror movie for one of our Halloween sessions or whatnot, so I can do it. Yeah. I can watch Interstellar. So besides films, there is a little bit of a game following that's come out. I know if you're on the Solar Punk subreddit, which if you're interested in this genre, I would definitely recommend going and checking those guys out. There's a tabletop game that one of the Redditors over there has been developing that looks interesting, and it's all about basically it's a deck building type of game that where you're trying to repair the earth from a climate disaster using like teamwork type of thing. So it looks interesting. It looks kind of fun. I haven't tried it yet. I don't even know the name of it because it's still in its early alpha testing stage for sure. But if you're more of a video game, I found two that really spoke to me as being kind of solar punk in nature. The first one is Stardew Valley. And we've talked about this a lot. This is on both of our lists is one of the best games that we've played. The basic premise is it's a farming simulation, not sin. It's a farming sim where you connect with the land, nature, while also connecting with your community. I mean, you can play the whole Joja Mart thing where you just sell your soul to the corporation. But most people who play it in a solar punk kind of capacity where they're trying to find balance in nature. Another one that came up that I have not played but looked fascinating is called Terra Nil. And it's basically a reverse city builder where a disaster has wiped out humanity. And so you've got the ruins of this civilization, and you're going to rebalance the ecosystem by undoing what humanity has done.
Interesting.
It looked kind of cool. Cause I mean,
fresh take on it.
We've all played city builders, right?
Oh yeah.
This just looks like a fun difference on it. So
nice.
And again, there's not a lot of video games out there. This topic is really new. I mean, it was formalized as a subgenre less than 10 years ago. So expect more things to come out.
Sure. So moving on then, solarpunk can also be described as kind of a social movement. So apart from like the media aspect, right? Apart from the books and the art and the games and the films, it's kind of gaining ground as a social movement. And there's a couple of different aspects of that. It definitely has aspects of socialism, socialist thought. So the real life movement definitely seems to be more leftist as far as on the political spectrum. There's many that are wanting to fight to end consumerism and build a life in a more equal society, not like a violent uprising, but like fight for the environment through, you know, peaceful means, protests and legislation. Most solar punk falls kind of under the pacifist spectrum. And then on the opposite of that is kind of the capitalist thoughts. So even though a lot of the solar punk movement falls into the anti-consumerism spectrum, there's also quite a few that feel that the movement can move forward through capitalistic theory. The thought there being that the act of selling items in order to make capital, they will be able to fund enough projects to change the world and make it better. Examples could be the bracelet sellers that turn a profit towards removing ocean plastics, Beads for Life that teach African women how to make paper beads, and then the money goes towards them building a better community. So definitely some thoughts on both sides of the spectrum there. And then also there's kind of a third aspect to it that's kind of more of an underground grassroots movement. Things like guerrilla gardening, so planting native plant species in public spaces where plants should not be, such as highway medians, tree boxes, vacant lots, playgrounds, the front yard if you live in an HOA. That's something I've definitely tried to do, is kind of push the line there about what I plant in my yard. And then also, obviously, the school strike for climate is a big one that most people have heard about. That's Greta Thunberg and that whole movement on fighting climate change.
Yeah. I'm sure there's other underground movements. I'm just not aware of them because I'm too old to really take on that punk philosophy myself. Speaking of which, there is some downsides to the punk movement. Any punk movement, whether it's the music movement from the 80s or 90s, the anarchists of today, there are down groups, or downsides. So some of the downsides of striving for a utopian reality, in my opinion, is there will always be an in-group and an out-group. There will always be tribalism. No matter how perfect your society is, there will always be the undesirables. So like the idea of a true utopian society, in my opinion, is damn near impossible. Pardon the language. It's not feasible in any way, because you will always have those in power and those out of power. There will always be class struggle. There will always be that type of issue. Speaking of class struggle, there will always be classism. In a movement like solar punk, there will be those that have an understanding of gardening and those that have an understanding of ecology, and the planners that will be dictating to the working class how to implement the type of thing. And then I know I said working class like a socialist, but that's really what it is. You're going to have the planners and those in power, and the workers and those that seek power. And the unfortunate reality is that there will be classism in any type of society of this nature, whether capitalism or socialist or communist, there will be classism. And then on the other edge of that classism comes the exploitation. And this is where I'm going to sound like a lefto pinko commie bastard. Exploitation of workers. If you have the divisions in society where you have the planners and the workers, there is going to be exploitation. It's true today. It was true in feudal times. It was true even in tribal times. Exploitation is something that will always happen. And I know all three of these sound like the same thing. Anthropologically speaking, they're not. But you can say they're all the same thing because they are related. So that's some of the issues of striving for utopian society. That being said, should we strive for a more equal and possibly a better community value-oriented society? In my opinion, yes. But I don't know how to make it fair for everybody. Another issue that's very detrimental to any environmental group is greenwashing. And the idea of greenwashing is you have these corporations that come in and they sell you on feeling good about yourself. So you'll have Nike that will come in and say, hey, we made this shirt and it's organic cotton and it's perfect. It's great for the environment. You should buy this shirt because it will make you feel good about buying from us. And the reality is it may be organic cotton, but it was still made in a sweatshop in Southeast Asia. And so you've got these big corporations that will come in and pretend to be environmental heroes who possibly are not. And that is an issue not only in solarpunk, it's any environmentalist will probably talk about greenwashing and like some of the issues with that. And then consumerism, the fact that these companies are coming in and telling you in order to feel better about the environment, you must buy more stuff, which ends up in landfills, which is counter to the entire movement. Another issue. And then this might be triggering to some of our listeners. Facts versus feelings. You get this a lot on Twitter and Reddit. People will say things like facts don't care about your feelings, blah, blah, blah. And they try to change an argument based on a certain feeling or a certain idea without scientific knowledge. It's used both sides of the political spectrum. It's used both north and south on the political compass. Everybody has used this argument to an extent, and it is just as prevalent in the punk movements as it is anywhere else. People will justify their feelings and make them come across as fact. And because they're great orators or they're great at people manipulation or social manipulation, social constructing, they're able to turn people on towards them. And so that's an issue that is also facing a lot of environmental movements, especially the realities of the possibility of a solar punk future. So did I miss anything?
I don't think so. I'm glad that you suggested this topic because I didn't realize this was a thing, and it's been really fun learning about it. So to kind of close out the main topic portion, just a couple of, I guess, open-ended questions about solarpunk as a movement. Is it possible and is it necessary? Do you think we could ever get to that place, and do you think that we should?
All right, so I'm going to start with possible. Is it possible? Anything's possible. I've heard of like these communities in the south of France that have basically gotten rid of money and turned into a anti-consumer society, where they trade labor for food or food for artisanal goods, and basically live in a community, one with nature, one with each other, kind of commune. The idea is not new. It's been around since the Communist Manifesto came over to America. The hippies lived in communes. So we've seen, to some extent, its success on small levels. Could it be a global level? I don't think so. I think people are too corrupt and desire power too much for it to actually take effect in a larger sample size than a commune of like-minded individuals. Would I like to see it? I think I would. I think it would be great if we all got back to nature, if we all figured out how to live in balance with the planet that we live on. One of the reasons that I approached Adam at the beginning of possibly doing this podcast is I had a dream that we could influence people to experience the healing nature of nature by being outside and feel better. And that's why every now and again, when we can't think of a good topic, we go back to things like solar punk or how to hike or how to camp or those type of how to's. It's something that I believe strongly in. So I would love to see it happen. In the future. Is it needed? Yes. With what's happening in Pakistan this week, with cities being washed out by monsoon flooding, with what's happening in Jackson, Mississippi, with an entire city on a water boiling notice without any ability to boil water. Like, the climate is going to get more drastic. So is it needed? Yes. Is it possible? Probably not. And I hate to be a defeatist. I hate to be that guy. But I just don't think humans have it in them to come together and work across cultural boundaries to actually make this a reality. What are your thoughts?
I would agree. For the most part, I think it is. I mean, something has to change. if humans plan to continue to live on this planet. And I'm not a scientist. I'm not a biologist. I'm an engineer. Me and Matthew McConaughey from Interstellar, right?
All right.
Exactly. So I defer to the experts on this kind of thing. But even I can see that, you know, things are trending the wrong direction. And so something needs to change. I don't know how much needs to change. I don't know by when. I think both sides of the political spectrum like to spout talking points and kind of bend the topic to fit their agenda, unfortunately. But I mean, I would kind of echo what you said. I don't know if we'll get there in time. Like, humans are very stubborn and very set in their ways. And by the time it gets bad enough that people are ready to come together, it might be too late. I don't know. I don't think you and I have a lot to worry about in our lifetime, but within the next five generations, I don't think it's too outlandish to think that some areas of the planet that are currently habitable might not be anymore, whether that's because they're flooded, you know, due to rising sea levels, or maybe they just get too hot in the summer. I think it's an inevitability if we continue on the current trajectory, I guess is what I'm getting at. I don't know what the slope of that function looks like, but it's going to get there if we don't change it. So that's my two cents.
You know what does bring me hope, though? The younger generation, the generation right below us, the Greta Thunbergs, the Gen Zers, they are really good at not putting up with BS. And they are more politically active than our generation will ever be. And it's really kind of cool to see this idea that possibly things could change because they're done putting up with it.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, every generation things shift a little bit further, right?
Yeah.
So
just thinking about it, I mean, I'm sure if our family ever does listen to this podcast, they would go, wait, you think that way? Heathens.
Yeah, probably.
So, yeah.
Okay. Well, I think that closes out the main topic. We did want to close with a mindfulness moment like we usually do. So as I was browsing for a thought to share, there's a blog that I like to read sometimes called Declutter the Mind that focuses on mindful topics. And I found a quote there that I really liked. And it says, "Today I will live in the moment, unless the moment is unpleasant, in which case I will eat a cookie." And I mean, looking back at some of the other mindfulness moments we've had on the podcast, things tend to get pretty serious. And I really liked this one because it just served as a good reminder for me that even when you're talking about being mindful, you don't need to be serious all the time. It's a good thing to do all things in moderation, including meditation and mindfulness. And I think humor is a valuable part of the human experience.
That's awesome. This quote actually made me smile. As you said it, my brain went to Join the Dark Side, We Have Cookies. And then I thought of the second movie in the Star Wars trilogy where Luke meets Yoda. And Yoda is just this little swamp monster who's just a pain in the ass. Just like playing with the droid and like stealing food and just having fun at Luke's expense. And I think it's true. Like, anybody can get too wrapped up in the seriousness of a situation. Sometimes it's okay to have a cookie.
Yeah, exactly. I like cookies.
Cookies are nice, yes. That brings us to the end of this week's episode. Were you going to take this?
Sure, I can do that.
Okay. I'll let you introduce it since this is more your cup of tea anyway.
Okay. So for next week, we recognize that recently we've been on a bit of a kick with the climate change topics. We do try and stay as balanced as we can here. So next week, we're going to swing back a little bit the other way, and we'll have an episode all about Firearms 101. However, this will be as non-political as we can possibly be. It will be completely educational and safety focused. However, due to community guidelines, we are not planning on having this on Twitch or Facebook. We will have it on YouTube only. So
at least the live show will only be on YouTube. It'll still come out in podcast form, edited every Sunday.
Correct.
I just wanted to put that out there.
Yep.
Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week.
See you then.